As a roving correspondent for All Things Considered and a syndicated columnist, Bob Garfield has been embarked on a search for American quirks and eccentricities. In his travels around America, he's found the largest collection of hotel room soaps, the Drainage Hall of Fame, and a museum and retail complex called Spongerama. He has a new collection of his pieces called Waking Up Screaming from the American Dream. Before we meet him, let's hear an excerpt of a piece he did for All Things Considered about one of his own adventures. The premise was this. While he was in Nashville on business, Garfield figured, why not try to become a country music star by writing a hit song? He enlisted the help of a songwriter named Rivers Rutherford. Then, taking the advice of people who say, write about what you know, Garfield tried to come up with a lyric about life in the Beltway.
Okay, wait. What about this? Everyone's so busy, you know, they're running behind. What if you ever have a conversation with somebody you can't have because you're calling their voicemail and they're calling your voicemail, right? And
then you're calling
phone tag. And, you know, by the end of it, you're just saying, tag, you're it, right?
Okay.
So what if there were a relationship building in an exchange of voicemail messages, and the whole song was just this exchange of voicemail messages, and the hook was tag, you're it?
Well, come to think of it, why not a song about telephone tag with your sweetheart? It's a common experience, harvested from my own life, completely consistent with my Inside the Beltway sensibilities, and just as the proprietor of the Bluebird Cafe suggested, it could be about a clueless guy who treats his woman wrong until she slaps him upside the head and gets him back on the road to love.
Just calling to let you know I got your message. I got your message a while ago. In my suitcase by the door, and now suitcase in my hand, 6 o'clock this morning. I hadn't talked to you in a couple days. The air was checking all my calls. 7 messages, yours was last of all.
Yeah, well, I mean, what if it tells a story? What story can we tell on the basis of two people who are just like electronic ships passing in the night?
I miss you. So,
yeah. I love you. I think you should leave the tag, you're it, call me when you can. Something, 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 I'm a busy man.
Tag, you're it. Call me when you can.
All told, it took us about 6 hours, and I don't mind telling you, I was dripping with satisfaction like gravy over hot biscuits. All we had to do now was play the song for his publisher, Jody Williams, president of MCA Music Nashville. Then it would be demoed, then shopped to likely artists, Garth Brooks, Willie Nelson, what have you, and my career would be launched even as I boarded the 6.05 p.m. flight back to Washington.
Well, on Garfield's trip home to Washington, who happened to be on the plane but Jimmy Carter, the former president who loves country music, Garfield recognized this coincidence as a great opportunity.
I traded seats with the Secret Service agent next to him and asked Jimmy Carter about his taste in music.
I listen to a country music station in America's Georgia, and I listen to the whole gamut of country music.
And is it possible, do you suppose, to bring a Washington sensibility to country music?
I'd be amazed.
Okay, well, then I just want to play this for you. Would you just listen to this?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. Whereupon the former President of the United States strapped on my headphones and listened to my song, flashing his famous toothy grin and, if I'm not mistaken, tapping his toe securely beneath the seat in front of him. So what do you think?
I think the song is good, and the music's good. I'd like to hear it every now and then on my country radio station. And, you know, you might get in touch with... Performer was very good, but if somebody like Willie Nelson or Tom T. Hall is one of my best buddies, I think they would like it and they could give you some good advice.
With your compliments?
Of course, sure.
Bob Garfield, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, I think it's really clever the way you enlisted Jimmy Carter and Willie Nelson to help you with this piece. How did you get to sit next to Jimmy Carter and ask him this?
Well, the first thing you have to know is I was flying first class. You know, I was doing a speaking engagement that I wasn't getting paid for, and as over the years I've learned that one thing you can do is ask people to fly you in comfort and style. So there I was in the first class cabin, and there was across the aisle from me was the Secret Service guy, and then there was President Carter. And I mean, I knew I was on my way back to Washington with a pretty good 7-minute story about me failing as a country music writer, you know, to pretending to be condescending and going and kind of getting my comeuppance. That was the story. And I thought, it'll be fine. I had some pretty decent tape and so forth. But when I saw Carter, the instant I saw him, I knew that this thing had transmogrified somehow, and if I could just get him on tape talking about this song, that I was on my way to a much better story. And so I just asked, and he thought about it a while, and ultimately he came around.
Now, what do you tell him? Did you tell him this is a comedy piece, and you'll be in on the joke?
I didn't tell him that at first. I just said, "Mr. President, I am." You know, I told him who I am, and I said I would like to interview you briefly on tape about country music. And he said, "Well, I'll think about it." And he went back to visit some people in the coach cabin of the plane. He came back, and this, by the way, was November 22nd. November 22nd was the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. I don't know what I was thinking of, but he walked back towards me. I said to him, "By the way, Mr. President, I'd still like to get a shot at you." Whereupon I was certain that this Secret Service guy was going to collapse on me in the airplane aisle. But he was not unduly alarmed. Anyway, he agreed, and he switched seats with the Secret Service guy, and he was very much accommodating. And he really liked the song. He was really tapping his presidential toe underneath the seat in front of him.
Your book is called Waking Up Screaming from the American Dream, and a lot of the people who you profile are pursuing their version of the American Dream, their version of happiness. And I wonder if you've given a lot of thought to what different people think happiness is, what people expect happiness will be.
Yeah, I have thought about that. And, while I'm sometimes hesitant to make, pronouncements that are supposed to apply to an entire country of 280 million people, I'm inclined to throw in with de Tocqueville and say that there is something extraordinary and unique to the American character about this whole idea of self-improvement. That, as I say in the introduction of this thing, we are not my dad was a shepherd and his dad was a shepherd and his dad was a shepherd, so I guess I'll be a shepherd too kind of society. We think that it is our birthright to, since we're in this land of opportunity, to find the opportunity for us and to, in one way or another, hit it big. I don't think the American dream is the white picket fence. I don't think that's it. I think the American dream is the big score, to do something enormous, something grand, something wonderful, something that will make the whole world take notice and will make you probably rich in the bargain. And this book is all about people who are trying to do something large. They just, by and large, I mean, there are some of the people in this book are actually, their efforts are redeemed by success. But for the most part, they end up doing nothing, just in a very large way.
Like the guy whose big idea was the condom keychain.
Yeah.
That one didn't work.
Did not work. Two guys came back, they're young guys, college graduates. In fact, I think they went to Princeton. And one of them came back from some studies in Thailand with this novelty he had picked up there, and it was a keychain with a condom in the key fob, and which I guess is handy for emergencies or just as kind of a conversation piece. And they thought that their ticket to riches was to just import these things by the hundreds of thousands or the millions. They thought, this was a zeitgeist situation they were in, and that the condom keychain was going to take them just places they had never even dreamed of being. And it did. It took them to a place they had never really dreamed of being. It took them into illiquidity at the age of 24.
Right. What's the most interesting thing that has happened to a person as a result of you profiling them?
That's a good one. I guess the answer is I don't know what the most interesting thing is. Although I did do a piece about a woman in New York who was a dominatrix. And she called herself a psychodramatist, but nonetheless, what she did was dress up in leather and flog men with whips and cat of nine tails and meat tenderizers and various other implements of torture. And it wasn't a prostitute, mind you, but she thought that she was doing some sort of psychological service, and the mainly lawyers who were her clientele apparently agreed because they were paying good money to come over to her place and be subjugated and humiliated. And I did a profile on her, I think it was a 750-word newspaper column, and I guess what happened was the radio talk shows, the AM talk shows, started coming to her big time, and all of a sudden she was, you know, kind of a demi-celebrity. And but when I revisited her about 5 years later, she had moved to much nicer quarters. She now had a large West Side dungeon with 9 employee dominatrixes or dominatrices or whatever you would say, and you know, her business had grown quite handsomely, and she said she owed it all to me.
Or were her clients judges instead of lawyers?
No, I don't know if she had an upgrade in the quality of the clientele, but she certainly had more volume.
What got you started in this direction, being, you know, a roving correspondent for NPR?
Back in 1985, I went hunting with my in-laws.
This is one of the pieces in your book.
That's right. I went hunting with my in-laws in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, actually north of Pittsburgh in the woods of Warren County, Pennsylvania. And the deal is my in-laws are Catholic hunters. I mean, they've been hunting since they were little kids, and they, you know, own a lot of flannel garments and a house full of rifles and so forth. And I grew up on the other side of the state in the Philadelphia suburbs, a nice Jewish boy who, you know, all of my guns had caps in them. I mean, they weren't real guns. And I was not exactly what you would call an outdoorsman. But after years of invitations, I finally accepted and went hunting with my in-laws and went to northwestern Pennsylvania and for 3 days, you know, tromped through the woods and did my level best not to freeze to death. And it turned out I actually had a very wonderful experience. I did a column about it for the New York Times. I did just a little op-ed piece for it. And it was funny. It was a very funny column. And the New York Times bought it, and they were going to run it on a particular Saturday or something like that. And 2 days before it was due to run, the editor of the op-ed section calls, and he says, look, we're not running the column. He says, you know, at the New York Times, we only have one sacred cow, and that's religion. And there are too many religion jokes in it. It has been decided by powers on high, and so, we, you know, you keep the money, but we can't run your piece. Well, I was crestfallen. I mean, number one, I was excited to be having an op-ed piece in the New York Times, but apart from that, I really liked this story. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, because I really wasn't a regular listener at the time, I called All Things Considered and said, look, I wrote this story, and the New York Times bought it, and they unbought it. And would you listen to it? And they said, yeah, we'll listen to it. And it was on that night. And all of a sudden, overnight, I was an NPR commentator and did a whole series of increasingly good, or I should say increasingly not good commentaries. I mean, I'm not a born commentator. I just didn't have all that much interesting to say, but it didn't stop me from trying to say it. After a while, I was very rapidly, actually, I was running out of steam. But at the same time, I was writing this newspaper column about, you know, traveling around the United States looking for these examples of bizarre Americana and quirks and idiosyncrasies and just sort of uniquely American traits that were otherwise unchronicled in America's newspapers. And the producer at All Things Considered, Art Silverman, it was encouraging me to do radio versions of those.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that my radio career was otherwise going to be very brief, I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And I was kind of off and running.
Did you earlier on in your career think that your career would be as a, you know, a straightforward reporter as opposed to as a humorist?
I always did lots of different stuff. Even when I was a general assignment reporter at a very small paper in Pennsylvania, I did, you know, a lot of straightforward general assignment reporting and went to the, you know, sewage treatment plant meetings, and I went to the school board meetings and all that stuff. But if there was a feature to be written that involved, you know, something with a light touch, I did those as well. And I chased after drug dealers and corrupt politicians, but I also, you know, did the cute stuff. So even from the very beginning, even as an intern, I did stuff that was supposed to, you know, that tried to make people laugh. And I never knew which way my career was going to go. I mean, I'd never really gave it all that much thought. I knew I wanted to get out of Reading, Pennsylvania. I knew I wanted to do that in the worst way. But I didn't know exactly where I was going to wind up. And even today, I really don't think of myself as a humorist. I think of myself as a journalist who reports strictly based on the facts and my subjective take on those facts. But in most of my reporting, I also try to make the stuff funny.
Bob Garfield, thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Bob Garfield is a roving correspondent for All Things Considered and a columnist for Advertising Age. His new book is called Waking Up Screaming from the American Dream.